Welcome to the My Stogie Mystagogy podcast with your hosts, Don Gonzalez
and Mark Connolly,
where we get together and discuss everything from the sublime
to the ridiculous.
All right, are you ready?
I am ready. I was born ready.
All right, what are you smoking and what are you drinking?
I am smoking an Arturo Fuente. What's the label say here? Let me put my eyeballs back on. This is an Extra Viejo Reserva Extra Viejo Añejo, number 55. It's a pyramid shape, it's a Maduro. These are cigars that are put out by Arturo Fuente twice a year. So it's a special edition. They're kind of hard to find. And you picked this up for me at Cigar Warehouse.
Yes.
And I appreciate it very much. We're smoking it today with Johnny Walker Double Black.
Okay. I too am smoking an Arturo Fuente Añejo, but I'm smoking the Robusto. And a little bit about the cigar. Mm-hmm. It is Dominican filler from the Chateau de Fuente, or however they call it. And it is a Maduro, but it's a broadleaf Connecticut that's been aged in cognac barrels.
Ah. Hence the cognac I'm picking up.
Yes, exactly. It is got, like we were saying before we went on air, that it's got a little bit of a oily sheen. I would use the description of espresso bean look. And the band is reminiscent of all the Arturo Fuente labels, their normal colors. And the thing that makes this distinct from the others is the white line. So.
I had not noticed that. Yeah, so Connecticut broadleaf, it's all Dominican. The wrapper is USA Connecticut broadleaf. The binder and filler are Dominican. And it's rated a 94.
On Cigar Aficionado?
On whatever random website I'm looking at here.
And I don't know if I mentioned it, but Mark, you just said that this is available twice a year, and the two times the cigar is made available in retail stores is during Christmas time and Father's Day. I happened to be at that store a week ago. I think it was a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, when they got their first shipment in and snagged a couple of sticks.
And I'm glad that you did. It's a good cigar.
So we'll come back and talk about the cigars and the, what can you say about the Double Black Johnny Walker? Obviously, it's a blend, right?
It's a blended scotch, and I'm not... I think there's a whole lot of snobbery involved with single malt scotches. A lot of people don't realize this, or maybe they do, but Johnny Walker Blue is a blend.
Right. So, at first, I was going to say not peaty at all, but it does have a slight peatiness to it.
It has on the back end for me, at the back of my throat. It's got the little bit of peat. It's pretty smooth. I like it, actually. And it's funny because I wouldn't think, it, you know, if you were just to ask me, so is the Johnny Walker Double Black really different from the Johnny Walker Black? And I'd have to say yes. And I prefer the Double Black to the Black. And I prefer the Double Black to the Blue. Because to me, the Blue is kind of it's so smooth, it's almost boring.
Well, I agree with that. I'll never, you know, we celebrated something. I can't remember what it was when I bought a bottle for us to share. And I'll never buy a Johnny Walker Blue again.
And I don't blame you.
I think for that price point, to think it's about $275 for, what is it, 750 milliliter?
Yeah.
There are other better bottles of scotch and bourbon that you can buy.
I agree.
I would even argue you can find some for half that price.
Well, like I said, I prefer this to that, and this was like a $50 bottle. So
I first learned about the Johnny Walker Double Black from some episode that Taylor Marshall did years ago when he did a review of scotches.
Really?
Yeah, I can't remember. He's evolved or devolved, whatever you want to say. But early in his career, as he was kind of figuring out what his audience was, he went through various iterations of what that show was going to be. And I can't remember if it was a podcast or a blog that he did on the scotches and where they fit in terms of taste profiles and cost and whatnot. Apparently, I've heard, I don't know this for a fact, that there's also a Johnny Walker Platinum.
Really? I have not seen that. I've seen red, I've seen green, I've seen blue, black, and double black.
And red is kind of their basic model, right?
Right. At least it's the lowest price one on the shelf. Like $23 for 750 milliliters.
The thing I remember about that, it's the first scotch I ever had in my life, and I must have been in my late 20s or early 30s, and I thought that was the most bitter thing I had ever consumed, and I hated it. And I remember an older guy telling me, just wait till you get older and you will appreciate the flavor.
Yeah, I wonder about that. Is that just is that a physical thing with being older and your taste buds respond differently? Or is it just I guess what I'm wondering, is it a lack in your ability to taste, or is it a...
I don't know, because in my youth, I was a gin and vodka guy.
Yeah.
You know, I only have gin every once in a while in the place. I used to have a tradition that on birthdays and anniversaries, Stacy and I would go to dinner at this place in Addison, which is a suburb of Dallas. Only place in the Dallas area that you can still smoke a cigar inside.
Hmm.
There's a place called Kobe Steakhouse, which is a Japanese restaurant, like hibachi style. You always had to wait, and when we would go wait at the bar, I'd always have a tank and tonic, one tank and tonic before we sat down to eat dinner.
Hmm.
And COVID killed that restaurant.
That's sad. Rosie and I used to have martinis early in our dating. And so for probably 3 years in a row at Christmas time, I'd get a gift set of Bombay Sapphire Gin with one or two martini glasses. So we have some interesting martini glasses as kind of a collection. And I read a lot about martinis when we were first dating, and the different vermouth and then what the ratio is. And apparently the original ratio was like 3 parts gin to 1 part vermouth. And then over time it turned into like the standard recipe was 11 parts gin to 1 part vermouth. And then it got to be you pour some vermouth in the glass and swirl it around and throw it out. And then there's, what's his name from England?
007?
No.
Churchill?
Churchill. Winston Churchill. He said you pour your gin in a glass, well chilled. You show it a bottle of vermouth. You nod to France. And then you're done. You drink your straight gin. So it's almost like a martini just became an excuse to drink straight gin without sounding like you're some sort of an alkie.
Well, I remember when I was in college, I went through a martini phase. And there, I think it's still there. There's an Italian restaurant on Lower Greenville. It had a really cool vibe because it had a little stage area where they would bring in a jazz band on the weekend.
Hmm.
And their shtick was they would take a block of ice, and when the block, it was more, I don't know what's the word, it was like it had been picked.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't smooth. That's what I'm trying to say. I don't know the word I'm looking for.
So they'd use like an ice pick to carve it out of a
larger block? Yeah, it was jagged. And they would put this ice, whatever you want to call it, ice rock, over the glass. And they would pour the gin over the ice into your glass. And then you, of course, had the option of having a dirty martini, which is, I guess, a little bit of
the olive juice. Yeah.
I always thought those martinis were very good.
Yeah, I don't really think a vodka martini is a martini, frankly. I mean, the original recipe is gin. And I'm not a vodka drinker. But I like gin and tonics, and I like martinis, and I like them dirty. And I like two or three olives in it. We used to go to a place a long time ago called the Balcony Club. I don't even know if it's still there, but it was in Lakewood. And it was attached to a movie theater there. And I cannot remember the name of the theater. But it was upstairs. And apparently, once upon a time, it was actually the balcony for the movie theater. And there was an old guy there that would play the piano, jazz piano. And it was a fun place to go hang out at. And I was reading that COVID has killed a lot of those places. The people haven't come back. They found other stuff to do, and they don't go out as much anymore.
Yeah. I did a little bit of research about that recently because I had a former colleague of mine who's invested in a gastropub.
Okay.
And asked me if I wanted to take a 1% interest in the gastropub.
Yeah.
And I was tempted, but then I started doing the research on restaurants and pubs, and like most of them close within a year.
Yeah.
And you got to wait 5 years to tell whether or not one's even going to be profitable and make it. Like, you don't really know if it's going to make it unless it lasts 5 years. And the evidence says that restaurants are projected to grow over the next 3 or 4 years in terms of sales, but I didn't do enough research to see whether or not that's in-person sales.
Yeah, I wonder how much of that is DoorDash and pickup.
Because with the exception of that time that we went to that old steakhouse for our birthdays, I haven't seen a restaurant full.
Well, and how much of that projection is just inflation? I mean, your sales increase if your hamburgers go from $3 to $7.
Well, fair, but I don't know. All right, so I think this next segment we'll call What Are You Thinking?
What am I thinking?
So, to be fair, I stole this. There is a sports radio station in the Dallas-Fort Worth area called The Fan.
Yeah.
And on Fridays, on the drive home, I think it's the 5 o'clock hour, they do this segment called What Are You Drinking and What Are You Thinking? Okay. And the number one rule is no extra talk. You just get into it, you say what you're drinking, and then you say what you're thinking.
Huh.
So, anyway. We were going to talk about, I don't know how to frame this. We're going to talk about formation.
Yep.
And I think we decided to talk about it within the context of
our membership in secret societies.
Yeah, but also I wanted to do a little bit of a throwback to something we learned in our master's program. It may have been the very first semester. Did we have spiritual theology in the first semester, or was it the second semester? I want to say it was the first semester.
I'm inclined to agree with you. It just seems that, I don't know.
Well,
it may be because I think, would that have been, because we had social doctrine and all that in the later years.
Yes, yes.
So I think the spiritual theology probably tied in with just the Christian anthropology that was, I think, was part of the first semester, or first year anyway.
So we read a book by, I think he's French, and I know he's OP, Jordan Oman.
Yep.
And I think the name of the book is just called Spiritual Theology.
Yes.
In the opening chapter, of course, I left my notes in my Jeep. He talks about schools of spirituality.
Right.
I went back and I read, I think we had a Quizlet over it, or paper.
Yeah.
I went back and read through it because it was resonating in my mind that I thought we had touched on this subject before. And there's a line in the book where Oman says that no one person embodies the entirety of what it means to be Christian.
Right.
Nor does one, like, group. Hence these multiple schools of spirituality.
Right.
That collectively represent the totality of what it means to be Christian.
Yeah.
But I also found it to, in my mind at least, and I think I did this in the paper, draw a comparison to the idea of the communion of saints.
Mm-hmm.
And I did write this in my in the paper or whatever it was, that it was striking to me that a lot of people during John Paul II's pontificate were making comments that he was declaring saints left and right.
Yeah.
But it was with some intentionality. These were they were more modern saints. They were from different walks of life, more representative of the totality of the church.
Right.
And so anyway, just in that framework, do you remember what the definition of school of spirituality is?
No.
All right, well, since I left my notes in the Jeep, I'll just throw it out there. It's just basically the form of spirituality that someone follows. And so we wanted to talk about formation in that context.
Yeah.
And this all came about from a conversation you and I were having about, we were talking about one parish in particular, my home parish, where the mission statement is, and I'm paraphrasing, it's not exact, bring people in, form them, and send them out to transform the world.
Right.
Which struck me as being very much based on the Great Commission.
Yes.
And we had talked, and we may have talked about this a little bit in one of the other episodes, that that should be every church, every parish's mission statement should be something like that. But then I also paused and said, you know, my experience at other parishes, and I'm relatively new to St. Anne's. We've been there 2 years, but I'm only recently getting involved in the parish. I haven't been able to figure out where the people are getting formed. It seems like I'm getting involved with RCIA in the spring. So obviously they do that. Everybody does some form of that. But my question is, what happens to people who are already Catholic? People that come back to the church,
mm-hmm.
people who are active in the church. And what we talked about a couple of weeks ago is we got into this discussion about continued education in the business world and how most people aren't wired to just do work on their own. They've got to be made to go to a seminar or that sort of thing.
Yep.
So when we were talking, we came up with this idea, you know, you talk a little bit about your involvement in the Order of Preachers,
right?
The Dominicans, and me as a cooperative Opus Dei. So that's kind of what we're going to talk about. But I think maybe starting off with like your origin story, how you came to become part of the Order of Preachers, and a little bit about the structure of how that is for the laity.
Yeah, I guess I would have to start with, you know, the conversation that all of the remaining people in our cohort that began our MTS program, as we were nearing the end, there was this kind of, you know, well, what are we going to do after this? And for some people, it was pretty clear they were younger than us, and they had specifically pursued this master's in theological studies as prep for becoming religious educational directors or some kind of position within the church. Of course, you and I have our careers that we have, and we weren't going to leave those for the high-paying gig as a RCI director or whatever at a church. And so I think for us, it was like, okay, so what do we do next? part of it involved Joe Catholic, which was something that you initiated, and you may talk about that when you get into yours. But it was at Joe Catholic that a guy named Patrick Norton gave a presentation on third orders. And so a third order, so there are different religious orders, and not all of them have third orders. Dominicans, Franciscans, Benedictines, Cistercians, I believe they all have third orders. And a third order is basically a group of lay people who have associated themselves with a religious order. And so he had given a presentation on all these different versions, and then he kind of revealed, if you will, that he was in the process of becoming a lay Dominican. And so after class, I asked him if he had some time to talk, and I wanted to know, okay, well, what is this? What does it mean that you're a lay Dominican or working towards that end? And what do lay Dominicans do? And so he started describing, you know, some of the things that are asked of a person when they become a lay Dominican, and it was study. It was liturgical prayer, specifically the Liturgy of the Hours. It was Bible study, and then try to take, you know, study, and then and the phrase is, you know, contemplate on God or Scripture, and then bring the fruits of your contemplation to others. And I was like, well, I kind of already do all that, because Rosie had gotten me the Liturgy of the Hours as a Christmas present several years earlier. We'd gone to school and obtained master's in theology. And I was involved in giving presentations at Joe Catholic and, you know, reading the daily readings and things like that. So I was kind of like, well, I'm kind of already Dominican, you know? So we met for dinner one night at Rosa's Cafe, actually, and talked about it quite a bit. And then I started going to the meetings. The order of preachers for lay people has a 1 year inquiry phase, and then a 1 year of candidate phase. And then if you decide you want to continue, move forward, then you take 3 years of what they call temporary promises. So lay people do not take vows. The typical vows are, they call them the evangelical councils, but they're poverty, chastity, and obedience. We don't take those vows, but we do make promises. So while we're lay Dominicans and considered full members of the order of preachers, we're not religious. We are associated with a religious order. We're not the religious order, but we're associated with it. But the Dominicans are very egalitarian, I guess, and they've suppressed the term third order, and we're just called lay Dominicans. Among other things, that means that I'm entitled to put the post nominals, the OP, at the end of my name. But if I choose to do so, I have to put Mr. at the front of my name. Because if I just put Mark Connolly OP, somebody may think that I'm a priest. So if I'm going to use OP, I am required to put Mr. So if I use OP, I put Mr. Mark Connolly OP. So I went to the inquiry and went through that year of formation. It was very, very intentional. There was basically 11 topics. And you went through each topic each month, and 1 month is held specifically for a retreat, some kind of a spiritual retreat. And then candidates are the same thing. And then when you become temporarily professed, there's not formal formation anymore. Instead, you're supposed to live out the rule of the order. Or lay, adapted to the lay. And you do that for 3 years because you're basically needing to figure out, am I really going to be a lay Dominican? Because if you decide to be Dominican, you're committing to working out your salvation through Dominican spirituality.
Can you just briefly, I think you have already done it, but just so it's clear, what is the rule for Dominicans?
So And we're in the sixth or seventh variant, I think. But it's a rule of life, basically. And it revolves around, there's a couple of mottos. One of them is Veritas, which is truth. The other one is to praise, to bless, to preach. And then there's the four pillars. And the pillars are community, prayer, study, and depending which province of the United States you're part of, the fourth one is either called apostolate or preaching. And what that means is you're supposed to pray very regularly. You're asked to pray the morning and the evening liturgy of the hours. This is not under penalty of sin, which is different because Franciscans, I think, have a requirement to pray the rule. But if you don't do it, it's a sin. So it'd be something you'd have to take to confession if you miss it. The Dominican approach seems to be, we want you to do it because you want to do it, not because you're compelled to do it.
Okay.
But you promise to do that.
Right.
Then there's the studying of scripture. There's the contemplation of what you're studying. And you are intended to bring the fruits of that contemplation and share it. And that's the preaching part. So prayer, study, and then community. We're members of a church and we're members of a religious order. Community is a big piece of that. It's a necessary reflection of the Trinitarian reality that we all live within. Because if you're not in community, you're not really capable of living out your vocation. Because it involves involvement with humans. We're made to be in some kind of relationship. Our Catholic religion is a very relational religion. And so the four pillars are probably the easiest to point at, because Veritas, sort of abstract, I think, for most people when they just hear, okay, well, your motto is truth. Okay, well, what does that mean? Well, it means something pretty specific. But it would be a long conversation to explain all the different ways people understand and don't understand what truth is. But the idea of praying regularly, the idea of studying regularly, and I don't mean just reading a book, I mean studying it, and then really thinking about it, thinking about the gospel reading, thinking about, you know, the writings of some saints, or, you know, the teachings of the Catholic Church, and then taking those and either writing blog articles or giving presentations or helping form other people. But the idea is that we're preachers. We're supposed to go out and share the good news with the world. And that's a, you know, today that I can couch that within the ask from Vatican II, that the responsibility of the laity is to renew the temporal order. So we're the people that are out in the world. The priests aren't out in the world. They can't really be in our workplaces. They can't be at the football game. I mean, they can, but you know, we are out there in the world where the priests are not, and it's our responsibility to try to bring some civilization and dignity and respect into the world and affect change, as you know, in whatever ways that we can. Just some you know, treating people respectfully with dignity, calling out falsehood, explaining what truth is. But if you don't have something to share, then you can't share it. Right. So the community is where it's like what we're doing right now. People interacting with each other, as the Proverbs, iron sharpens iron. It's very real. Living that out. So there's a 3-year temporary promise. And at the end of that time, you have two choices. You can extend it. You can say, I'm out. Or you can say, I want to do permanent promises. So I am a permanently professed lay Dominican at this point. There is a process, if you decide it's not for you, to where you can formally ask to be released from your promises. but it's expected to be a lifelong commitment. That's an overview.
Okay. If you had to point to one or two things that primarily attracted you to that spirituality, what would you say they were?
I think it's the spirituality that syncs up with the way I'm built. I've always been a reader. I've always liked philosophy. Philosophy is the preamble to theology. It means it walks before theology. I have always been partial to the ancient philosophy, medieval, the scholastics. And then I like to understand what the Catholic Church teaches, because I've always found it, when you really understand what Catholic Church teaches, it's eminently rational, and it just appeals to me on a very deep level. So it's the study and the prayer that I think were the two main things that attracted me. And then I've always liked to write, and throughout my life, people have come to ask me questions about stuff. Why, I don't really know. I don't know what they saw or heard or what made them feel comfortable, but they will ask me questions about religion. And, you know, I never initiate it. And that may seem odd. I never initiate a religious conversation. It just kind of happens. And when I got the master's degree and I realized people were going to ask me questions, I felt that I need to keep growing, because you get a master's degree, you're not done. And I'm going to use a martial arts analogy. There was a martial arts that I trained in, and when I was given a black belt, I was told, now make it white. And the idea of a black belt was you were now released to continue your own training. And the thing about turning the black belt white was, the idea was that you would be working so hard and sweating in it so much that you would bleach it out, basically. So I kind of, in my mind, equate the master's degree with a black belt, and it was basic. Just now you begin to learn. You've been given all the tools. Now go learn and use it. So that's what attracted me.
Okay. So I like that part that you said at the end about go learn, because there are all sorts of studies that talk about how the best way to learn something is to teach it.
Yes.
And that's very much part of what you do.
Yeah. And I'm partial to the idea of, if you can't explain it to where a 12-year-old could understand it, meaning that you can come up with explanations that don't involve buzz phrases and big words and all that, then you might not understand it yourself. So when a 12-year-old is asking you about something complex, if you can explain it to them to where they understand the concept, that means you understood it. If you're just throwing out, you know, transubstantiation and, you know, words that they don't understand, and you can't explain it to where they can understand it, then that means you don't understand it. So that part's always just attracted me. I there is something very satisfying about having someone ask a question that's complicated and working through and getting to the answer, and them going, oh wow, I see. That's very satisfying.
Yeah, my experience with you teaching at Joe Catholic in particular is that you're pretty good at that. I think I described you once as someone who can take the complex and make it simple and understandable.
Yeah, I think that if you fail to do that, you're not really doing anything except stroking your ego, I guess. Talk too much, and I had to relight my cigar.
I know, but you are smoking that cigar faster than normal.
Good cigar.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a smaller cigar, yeah. You're further down than I am, and that's unusual, because I call it smoking them hot. I don't know if that's an accurate term. I tend to puff more and
yeah
on it. You picking up any flavors from it? It's an ongoing joke here because Mark claims he didn't have a palate, but I pick up a little bit of like a coffee flavor in there, a little bit of leather, and there's some sort of spice in there. I can't put my finger on it. I've seen some people say nutmeg, but I know what nutmeg tastes like, and that's
I don't get nutmeg. When you said coffee, I did think of espresso.
Okay.
I do know Rosie and I bought a kit years ago that had, it was for wine tasting, and it had little tiny bottles of different flavors, and you were supposed to buy specific wines and then find those flavors in that wine. So I think there is an education that can happen. Over the years, I've picked up, there have been times when I've been able to pick up pepper. That's probably the most common one that I pick up. I have picked up cedar in the past. I have picked up leather. I have picked up coffee. But most of the time, I don't really think about it. My tendency is to puff and then sip and just let those two flavors kind of meld together. And that's what I enjoy. What those flavors are, I'd be hard pressed to tell you, but.
And I puff and swig.
So, Opus Dei, work of God.
Work of God. So, my origin story begins shortly after attending a chirp treat weekend. Christ Renews His Parish, which is now, I think, called Welcome. Kevin's nodding his head and saying that's correct because he's been to like 8 of those retreats. What's the real number?
He's counting on his fingers.
Participated 1, hosted 5.
All right, so he goes to a relatively small parish, so he's part of like their continuation team. So I'm just giving him grief. So anyway, I attended a chirp weekend. It was actually the first one that we had at our old parish, St. Catherine, and for some crazy reason, I guess the will of God, I discerned as the lay director for the team, which meant I was responsible really for, I wasn't in any position to direct anybody. I would say I was more of a facilitator for our formation sessions. If Stacy was here, my wife, she would tell you that I don't, when I get into something new, like when I started getting into cigars or fountain pens or whatever, I don't do it half-heartedly. I research and I throw myself into it. So I decided, since I'm going to be the lay director, I didn't feel like it was enough, the materials that we had from CHIRP at the time. I didn't feel were enough to do these formation meetings, so I started reading outside material. And I'd only been back to the church for about a year and a half. And CHIRP really ignited a fire in my belly to really be back. I took that seriously. And so I started reading. And I kept stumbling across these writings of St. Jose Maria. And I got to backtrack a little bit. Part of what I was experiencing, which I think a lot of people experience, is when I came back into the church, I thought, all right, I've got to quit my job and I've got to go work for the diocese, the parish, or go on mission. And I was struggling with that. And when I stumbled across the writings of St. Jose Maria, especially The Way, which is a tiny booklet that he's most known for, it's a collection of like small quotations and really, meditations is what they are.
And they're challenging.
Yes, yes. And I gathered very quickly that what he was talking about, I learned later, it's called the integrated life. And essentially what he was teaching is that you don't have to quit your job or anything like that. That you can be a saint exactly where you are in the workplace and the people that you encounter. And I found that very attractive. And it's very ordinary. There's nothing like you know, super fancy about it.
Right.
And more recently, having reflected on Christ calling the apostles, I noted that Jesus, for most of the apostles that he called them while they were at work.
Yeah.
You know, the brothers while they were fishing, Matthew while he was collecting taxes. And so that, you know, there's kind of the bookends to all of that. So anyway, I was attracted to that. Long story short, because there's a lot of stuff that took place in between that's not really relevant for tonight's discussion. I really got interested in him, and then this kind of was taking place at the same time that the Dan Brown book was out, The Da Vinci Code.
Oh, yeah.
That everybody was talking about Opus Dei.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, what is Opus Dei? I made a commitment to find out what they were and were they in Dallas. And I found the center here in Dallas. And I called them, which is unusual because most people are introduced to Opus Dei by a friend. They meet somebody who's a cooperator, a member of Opus Dei, and they get invited to a recollection or to a talk or something. And that's how they get it. That wasn't me. So I called them out of the blue. And I met with a gentleman who's now one of my very good friends. His name is Paul Hunker. And we started having conversations over lunch. And I went to a couple of what they call evenings of recollections or monthly gatherings where there are two or three talks that are given, two by the priest, one by a lay person. And it's in between there, there's an examination of conscience and benediction and adoration. And after a while, I decided I wanted to be formally involved. And Opus Dei is different than the third orders. It's not an order of any sort. It's unique in the church canonically. It's what's called a prelature, a personal prelature.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't have vows. They have contracts. Sounds kind of odd.
Yeah.
And I obligated myself to be in a cooperator, which means I'm not a member, but it means I participate in all the activities of Opus Dei. And I commit to following what we call plan of life.
Okay.
And part of that is I financially support the organization with monthly donations, which I count as part of my tithing to the bigger church.
Right.
And in addition to that, I have the plan of life in particular is a series of prayers that I do, like a morning offering. I commit to spiritual reading and mental prayer every day, praying the rosary and closing out the day with an examination of conscience. Going to Mass regularly, and if possible, going to Mass daily, and committing to going to the Sacrament of Reconciliation at least once a month, and participating in spiritual direction. And then one other thing, too, the annually. It's really kind of neat to me because you got a weekly commitment, you have a monthly commitment, and you have an annual commitment. The annual commitment is you go to a retreat. It's a silent retreat. It's normally a three-day retreat. So that's kind of that. What attracted me to all of this is a couple of things. Number one, it gave me structure to my prayer life that I didn't have before.
Mm.
And I found it to be fairly simple. Some of those I was already doing, but it was kind of haphazard. Yeah. Now there's a formality to it, and I've
right.
added my own component. I think I've talked about this before. I journal my morning meditations, and then I go back at the end of the week and read through those, and I synthesize them to see if there's some sort of theme. I like the formation part of it. You know, the going to those monthly recollections, that's formation. You're generally taught on one of the virtues. And as you spend more time with Opus Dei, there actually, if you decide you want to become a member, you can be sent off for theological classes and things of that sort. But the core of the spirituality is twofold. One, a heavy emphasis on your filial relationship with God, that you are a beloved son or daughter of God. That defines your identity.
Mm.
And that secondly, that this pursuit of holiness in the ordinary.
Mm.
And so that your work can become prayer and all of that. And that gave me a peace of knowing that I didn't have to leave my work. I didn't have to leave my family.
I think that's a really, really important point that you made, though, about the holiness in the ordinary. Because I do think that a lot of people struggle with the idea of how can I be holy? I'm just a dude. You know, I go to work and I watch football games and I drink whiskey. I'm not holy. So can you elaborate on that a little bit?
It's the third time I've had to relight the cigar.
Because we're talking too much.
The Casa Fuente didn't do this. Can you do me a favor and ask the question again, please?
Yeah, you mentioned finding the holy in the ordinary. And I think that's a really important point. Because I think a lot of people don't perceive that it's even possible to be holy and ordinary in just your day-to-day world.
Well, I'm going to use a couple of analogies. The first is that I don't know that it was explained to me this way, but it just kind of came to me that the majority of the liturgical year is ordinary.
Right.
And one thing that I specifically learned through going to evenings of recollection is reflecting on the life of Jesus, the majority of his life was ordinary.
Yeah.
And particularly those hidden years. And one of the things that we reflect on through the use of things like Lectio Divina is everything in the gospel that Jesus did, the ordinary stuff he did, he divinized. And like he worked in the carpenter shop with Joseph. And so if Christ did it and it was holy and sanctified, then if we do it, you know, in Joe Catholic, the running joke, because I use this example quite a bit, is that taking out the trash, which is something I don't like to do. And when Kevin grew up and moved out of the house, that became my job.
Yeah.
That if I could view just taking out the garbage as a form of prayer. St. Jose Maria teaches that our work can be prayer.
Mm-hmm.
If we're intentionally offering it to God, if we're intentionally doing our best work as an offering, that's part of it. That's part of the prayer part of it. But then the other part of it, too, is being intentional about and I think this is the most important part, living a Christian life where you are, that you don't, he says this in one of his points in the way, is that you don't leave your Catholic hat at the door when you walk into the workplace.
Right.
That your Catholicity defines who you are, that people see a difference in you. That may be the fact that you're cheerful and joyful.
Right.
Doesn't mean that you're quoting scripture, hitting people over the head with the catechism. But that there's something unique and different about you that's attractive.
Right.
And what that is your relationship with Christ. And through that, friendships are developed and opportunities to witness to people arise from that. And that in your sphere of influence, it's one of the other key elements. It's not the main thing, but it just, it's a natural component of everything else is apostolate, of witnessing and bringing people in to the faith. But it's very organic, and a lot of times, and we've talked about this before, it's playing that long game, and it's very relational, is that the word? Like developing relationships with people. And in a way, it's very pastoral. Like you're meeting people where they are, you're listening to them, you're loving them, you're being Christ to them. And in that process, you're slowly bringing them to Christ.
Yes.
So all of that's been very attractive to me. And it's made it, whenever I have difficulty of like, why am I doing the work that I do? Then I realize, well, wait a minute, there's a reason. And I get daily affirmation of that. So I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, I think your point about Jesus, you know, from the time he was 12 until he was, I guess, 33 or 30, whichever. He was still Jesus, and he was just doing stuff. And I would imagine if we could talk to people that ran into him in his teens and 20s, that they would have favorable comments. about his, you know, he was a good Jew. You know, he was, you know, going to temple. He was doing all the things that a person would do.
Well, there's a line in scripture, something like he did all things well.
Yeah. So I think it's important for people to recognize that taking out the trash can be a prayer.
Well, I think the other thing about it is that, I don't know if we've talked about this on air recently, but with men in particular, this ties into formation, which probably get us to the beat of our conversation, is that I've seen it happen so many times. I think it's happened to Kevin more recently. I know it's happened to both me and you. When a guy hits a certain point in his spiritual development where people see a change in him, or maybe him even internally, what's next?
Right.
And the temptation is, well, then I need to be on the altar.
Right.
And if you're a married man, then the only thing that a lot of people get pointed towards the diaconate. Well, you should be a deacon. You know, I heard that a number of times. I even, for a very short amount of time, discerned for the diaconate. You know, the reality is, the majority of the church is the lay faithful.
Right.
We make up the church. And I, very quickly after getting involved with Opus Dei, I figured that out. And I was like, I can reach more people as a lay person. And if I'm living that out.
Yeah.
¿Cómo estás? Bien.
Bien. ¿Cómo estás?
Muy bien. ¿Usted?
Bien. Gracias. I think it's a, and I don't mean this in a, oh, look at me. I mean it if you're, I think it's even more attractive if other guys see a normal guy living out his faith.
Yes.
Every day. Because if you're a deacon, and you know, a lot of deacons still have their regular jobs.
Yeah.
Well, they're like, well, of course he's that way. He's, you know, Deacon Walt.
Right.
But if you're just regular old Don, or regular old Kevin, or regular old Mark, they're like, what's he got going on? And the thing that most resonates with me is when I have people that I know don't currently have any sort of spiritual life.
Yeah.
They're not going to church. They're not praying. When they see something. And for me, the one that was, and I don't want to say that I knew this when it was happening. I knew it later. Like when my mother died. And my mother died on a Tuesday. I came and hung out with y'all.
Mm.
And the next day I went to work.
Yeah.
And I wasn't walking around gloomy.
Right.
I was being cheerful. And people were like, what the heck? And yeah. I had somebody ask me a week or two later, how could you be so cheerful? How could you even come to work?
Yeah.
And I had an answer for them. I was like, number one, I was like, rooted in my faith, my mother had a good death. You know, all of her sons were with her. I was able to get her a priest. She got the last sacrament. I was very peaceful about it, especially with the amount of time I spent with her. My mom was a very strong Catholic woman. So I should be happy about that. And also, if I believe what I believe, then I know mom's in a good place. It only makes sense to go back to work the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And it only makes sense to be cheerful. That resonated with people.
Yeah.
I didn't know it in the moment. But in the context of the big scheme of things, that's a little way to be able to witness to other people.
Yeah.
Because we've talked about this before. What's the biggest objection to believing in God is like, why does God let bad things happen?
Right.
And it's like, if this dude can be cheerful after he loses a parent, then maybe it just puts that thought in a person's mind of, what does he have that I don't have, and how do I get that?
Yeah. Something's happening, and they don't really understand it. Because, let's face it, I think we both have known people who have had a significant death in their family, and they struggle with it for a long time. And it says something about how rocked their world was, that the fact that someone died impacted them, when we all know everyone dies. You know, I think it was the great philosopher Jim Morrison who said, no one gets out of here alive.
Well, I think, you know, people don't like to think about death.
No.
And I read a reflection a couple of weeks ago. I think it's St. Charles. Is it Borromeo? Is that how you
Borromeo,
say it?
Borromeo, yeah.
There's a story about him playing chess. And someone asked him, if you knew you were going to die at this very moment, what would you do? And he said, I'd finish my game.
Yeah.
Because he was ready.
Yeah.
In that moment. And it, reading that struck me because I had conversations with my mother when she was sick. She was ready.
Yeah.
She was a woman of faith. She wasn't afraid of death.
Yeah.
San Jose Maria, I think, calls death, I think he calls it our sister. I could be wrong about that, but he makes it very relational.
Yeah.
That we shouldn't fear death because it's not an end. I think, you know, we lose sight of the idea that we are really immortal beings.
Yes.
When you think about our souls.
Right.
And what that all means. And I, you know, I think part of the sadness in the world is that people think this is all that there is.
Yeah.
And we've talked about this before because I have a few atheist friends and I always just am baffled by the way they live their lives. Because if this is all that there is, then I would be inclined to just give in to all the pleasures of the world.
Yeah. Go big or go home. Just, you know, yeah. Why not?
Because I think if you're an atheist, you only have two options. You either become a heathen or you become depressed.
Hmm.
And I mean, I don't know. I've not asked that question before, point blank. That's just my take on it. You know, I've heard people say, I have a friend who says, there's a quote from some book, with, how do you pronounce that name? Jack Kerouac?
Kerouac.
Kerouac. What is that book that he wrote? It's On the Road or something like that?
I think it's On the Road.
That God is Pooh Bear.
Yeah.
And this guy interprets that to mean that God is a comfort, that he's a human construct. And my pushback on that is like, dude, believing in God isn't easy. When we screw up, and you and I talked about this Saturday night, we wrestle with that stuff.
Yeah.
Because it's so much easier not to care.
Yeah.
Like when you care, it's like, oh, I hurt somebody's feelings. I wasn't Christ to that person.
Right.
You wrestle with those things. And it's okay to wrestle with those things. That means you're on the right path.
Yeah.
That's not something that should lead to despair. It should be like, okay, I'm wrestling with this. What do I do with it? How do I take a good out of that bad? Or how do I improve and do better the next time?
Yeah. Well, part of it is that idea of constant growth as you're working towards your ultimate end, which is to be with God.
Yeah, that cigar decided to be with God. It just didn't. It did not want to stay lit. That's easy when it's, you know, your daily cigar, but when it's a $12 stick or 15, however much that stick costs, it's like, oh, well, it is. I've always said a cigar will tell you when it's done. That cigar is done. So formation, I don't know that we talked about it very much.
Well, I think I alluded to it a little bit with my black belt analogy.
You did.
You know, there's. I think you could take almost any vocation or any skill or whatever. There is a period of time where people who know more than you are teaching you. This is how you do it. This is how you hold a nail so you don't pound your thumb. This is how you swing the hammer so that you don't bend the nail. So people who have been there before will show you this. You do it this way, you do it that way. I think musicians, they learn the scales, you know, they learn the whatever the chords are on a guitar. They learn, they have exercises for their fingers. But all of them at some point have to walk away from their teacher and continue the growth in their whatever it is that they're pursuing. And I think it's necessary for grown people to be able to do that with their faith. You at some point, you have to take responsibility for your own formation. But that doesn't mean all by yourself. What we do here every week when we meet, there's some formation involved in that.
Right.
Because we're asking about the difficult questions, or we're talking about some weird thing in the politics of the day, or something that happened at work. And we kind of walk through, you know, this happened and that happened, and this is how I responded. And I kind of wish I'd handled it this way instead. Or we ask each other questions. What would you do in this case? You know, that's part of the community. And it's interesting to me because the community aspect comes up in both of our vocations.
Yes.
Speaking of vocations, you know, one of the things that I think a lot of people don't realize is that marriage is a vocation. And it's a critically important vocation for a viable society for us to live in, for one. And it's important for your growth as a human being.
And it's the core community.
Yeah, it is. And it is a kind of a reflection, you know, they say, as you know, we see God as through a glass darkly. You know, a family is a kind of a small s sacrament pointing to God, because it's an attempt as material beings to live the Trinitarian reality that we have with the three persons and one God, because that is a relationship. That's the basis of the whole Trinitarian truth is it's a relation between God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit. The mystery part being it's one reality with three persons. And somebody was asking me, what, you know, so did I understand the Trinity now? And I was like, no, I do not. But I keep seeing reflections of it everywhere, because we are made whole by being with others. In our retreat that we had this past Saturday, for, you know, we did an Advent retreat, and that's part of our annual, you know, 1 month where we didn't have formation for people. We did a retreat instead. Father Philip commented that God is love, and that as love, when he shares with us, because we're creatures and not immaterial, we receive his love as faith and hope. And I thought that just really struck me as what an interesting way to put it. So love is simple. Love is one thing. But because we are material, we get it in different manners. It's the one thing. And so we can live out that love in our relationships with our spouse, with our friends, with our family. That faith and that hope as our reception of God's love is the Trinity. I mean, it is pointing at the Trinity, in my opinion.
Well, I want to circle back to something that you said about community as it relates to formation. It's, I think one of the things that I think that the order of the preachers and Opus Dei have in common is the intentionality of forming its members.
Yes.
But also, in that context, there's this expectation that you will take ownership of your own formation as mm-hmm. well. That we're going to provide you with some of the bare minimum tools And in our case, part of that is also spiritual direction. It's expected as a cooperative Opus Dei that, you know, like when I meet with my spiritual director, he's going to ask me, what are you reading? You know, what's your spiritual, what are you reading for your spiritual reading this month? What are you doing to learn more? And
yeah,
I think that's important. And I think that's what's lacking in a lot of parishes, that there aren't systems for that. There are going to be people. I think you and this isn't to toot our horns. I think it's just the way that we seem to be wired, that even before our involvement in Opus Dei or the Order of Preachers, we were both already self-learners because that's just the way we're wired.
Right.
I think that both of us kind of came back into our faith intellectually.
Yeah.
And so it's a natural thing for us. I don't think that's the case with a lot of people.
No, and it doesn't have to be.
But what I was getting to with that is the notion of formation is, like, even if that doesn't come naturally to you, people need to be nudged in that direction. And so that what I was trying to get to is that if parishes can create environments in which people, whether it's RCIA or something else, and I don't know what that is right now, people get a fundamental formation. They're saying, hey, come to this, you're going to learn the basics. And then part of the basics towards the end of that is like, here's what it means to have a daily prayer life. Here's what it means to grow in your faith, learn your faith, because to learn your faith, you're able to share your faith. And obviously part of this is witnessing through your life, like, for sure. But inevitably, people are going to encounter questions. And you have to be able to answer those questions.
Right.
What was that? 1 Peter 3:15? You have to be armed with some basic knowledge.
Yes.
So teach them the basics first, and then teach them how to learn. It's that we talked about this the other day. Don't give them the fish.
Right.
Teach them how to fish.
Yeah.
Teach them how to be self-learners and, you know, inspire them to do that.
Because
there's a richness there.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of good resources available. People just, we talked about this the other day, people just don't know what questions to ask. Well, maybe they know what questions to ask. They may just not know where they need to go. I don't know.
I want to make a comment about intentionality, because we had an example of it just a minute ago with Ernesto. So Ernesto, for those listening to the podcast, he came in and greeted Don and shook his hand. That's very intentional, and both of the Cuban males in this house do that. I know they shook your hand, right, Kevin? Every time I see them in the morning or when I come home from work, they come up, intentionally greet, shake hands, and basically say hi, you know, it's good to see you, basically.
Yes.
And there's something very holy about that, I think.
Mm.
It is an intentional meeting, a greeting, I see you, I recognize you, I'm glad you're here. And it's very intentional with them. And I think that is a real virtue to do that. And I like it. It's nice for that kind of, again, just an intentional greeting. It's a deliberate connection that he's making. And I like it. And I think that in our day-to-day lives, if we make those intentional efforts to connect with somebody, I think everybody benefits from that.
Yeah, I think you're spot on with that, is that formation is good, but at the end of the day, the thing that's more important is being rooted in your faith and your encounters with people every day.
Yeah.
And bringing that joy.
Yeah.
And that can be done with a simple handshake.
Yep.
Or a smile.
Yeah.
Over over the years, I heard he's very difficult to work with.
Yep.
He killed John Candy.
What?